Thankful to be here this afternoon. Thankful for your fellowship and for your sweet hospitality and the friendship that you've showed my wife Linda and I since we've been here. And I'm thankful for this opportunity to stand before the Lord's people and speak to you concerning our Lord. I'm always thankful for an opportunity to speak about the Lord. This afternoon, I want to actually go into the next chapter, the 17th chapter of Acts of the Apostles. But before we begin reading, I want to ask a rhetorical question, a question that perhaps all of us have asked ourselves in the past and perhaps in the recent past. As a nation, how did we get in the mess that we're in? Did you know that it didn't just happen? It didn't just happen. Now, I want you to understand, I'm not one of these conspiracy guys, and I'm not going to talk politics. I want to talk Bible. But hopefully, as we get into this, we can connect some dots and figure out how we got in the mess we're in today. Why are people who love one another not speaking to one another? Why is there so much acrimony in place of civil discussion? What happened to statesmen politicians instead of ideologues that are political hacks? How did we ever get in the mess we're in today? Several months back, it's been a couple of years ago now, I was listening to a fellow on the radio, and he was giving his interpretation of the Declaration of Independence. And in listening to it, and it occurred to me that I didn't know if I agreed with him, but what I did know is that I didn't remember enough of the details of the Declaration of Independence to say what you're saying is not correct. So I went back and read the Declaration, and I would encourage you to do that when it's convenient for you to do so. But I went back and read it, and the Declaration of Independence is basically a document that says we want the world to understand why we are declaring our independence from England, and the reason that we're doing that is governments are an expression of a social contract among its citizens to protect their human rights and administer and protect their human rights, and King George has violated that. And we've sought redress, and he's ignoring us. So we feel like the only thing we can do, since he has broken the terms of the civil contract, the social contract, the only thing that we can do is separate ourselves from him and make a new social contract, which is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Well, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence states this. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these is life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which means the practice of well-being. Well, as I read that, I thought, wait a minute. If human rights were given to us when God created us, that ought to be in the Bible. I ought to be able to go to the Bible and find that. And if it's in the Bible, and God gave us our human rights, then he's in charge of them. He's in charge of them. Which means that he has moral authority where our rights are concerned. That he has moral authority. If you turn with me now over to the 17th chapter of Acts of the Apostles, the Apostle Paul is in Athens by himself. Now he's there because he's been run out of town two or three times. And finally he's delivered to Athens, and he goes into the marketplace there in Athens, and he's taken by the gross idolatry that's in this city, that every place he turns, there is the practice and promotion of idolatry. And he begins to speak to people in the marketplace. While he's doing that, some folks hear him, and some people who are followers of the philosophy of the Stoics, and some people who are followers of the philosophy of the Epicureans, hear him, and they take him into custody. And they take him to Mars Hill to have his case presented to the Areopagus. Now, the Areopagus was not just a bunch of old men sitting around on top of a hill having philosophical discussions with one another. They did engage in philosophical discussions, but understand this. Do you all recall how Socrates committed suicide as a way of accomplishing the penalty of death that was brought against him? Do you know who imposed that penalty of death on him? It was these guys, the Areopagus. They were the ones that did it. There were two charges brought against Paul. One was that he was a babbler. And that word babbler is an interesting word. It in today's terms, it carries the connotation of being a panhandler. Someone that is using language and appeal and that sort of thing to get money without really doing anything, but just, you know, has a good story and is telling a good story. And the other charge was he was a setter forth of strange gods. Now, historically, before Athens was under Roman rule, the penalty for bringing forth strange gods was death. That was the penalty against Socrates. Now, there were some other charges against him, but that was one of the charges against Socrates. Once the Romans took over, they had the same law. Now, the Areopagus had been sitting for about three centuries up to this point. And those of you that are familiar with Roman history understand that the Romans really wanted to be the Greeks. They wanted all the culture and all of that stuff. They wanted the kind of respect for intellect and justice and those sorts of things that the Greeks had. Of course, rather than relying on philosophy and logic and that sort of thing to promote justice, they relied on brute force. And so they never quite attained the level of respect of the citizenry that the Greeks had, but they also lasted a lot longer than the Greeks in terms of who's running things. But I make that point to bring out this point, that the Romans had tremendous respect, and in fact, in many ways, had fashioned their legal justice system after the Greek legal justice system, and the Areopagus was like the Supreme Court of Greece, and the Romans didn't turn over. They never overturned sentences passed by the Areopagus. So that if the Areopagus said, Paul, you are guilty of setting forth a strange god, and the penalty for that, just like it was for Socrates, is death, and we're turning you over to the Romans would rubber stamp that, and Paul was finished. Paul was finished. Now, when you read this narrative, you discover that it seems like, you know, that there's a kind of a friendly air in all of this. Well, the reason for that is that the Areopagus didn't see judicial procedure as an adversarial pursuit. Rather, they saw it as a pursuit of truth, for truth. And so they would give as much opportunity to the person accused to present their case and to show how what they were doing represented truth. And so there was a civil tone that you don't find in the American legal system today in courts necessarily, even though we try to do that. So this is serious. This is serious. Paul is on, the point that I'm trying to make here is that Paul was on trial for his life. He was on trial for his life. And he knew that. And so when he's given opportunity to present his case, to plead his case, he deals with it from the perspective of an issue that the Greeks had struggled with down to the present time. You see, if we read this, in verse 22 it says, Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, Ye men of Athens, I perceive in all things you're too superstitious. Now, that doesn't mean, that was not a criticism. What he was saying was, I perceive that religious matters are very important to you. That in all matters, that in all of your jurisprudence, in all of your discernment, in all of your efforts to pass judgments, you take religious matters into consideration. He goes on with this. And he says, For as I passed by and saw your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, To the unknown God. The Greeks had something going for them that we in America don't have going for us today. The Greeks understood that there were some things about religion that they did not know. They also understood that these things about religion that they didn't know could be very important, and they needed to take the fact of their ignorance into consideration. And so they built a statue or erected an altar to the unknown God. Now, let me explain to you how it is that they came to the realization that there was something that they didn't know. You recall that it was Epicureans and Stoics that that approached Paul and took him into custody. Well, the Epicureans were pantheists, and they believed that God was in everything, and everything had God in it. And when a person died, they believe that individual's personhood continued to live, but not as an individual, that it was reintroduced into this pantheistic deity. And so there was no personal experience after death. That when you died, your person was just incorporated into this God everywhere concept, and you were no longer you consciously after death. The Stoics, on the other hand, didn't believe in afterlife. That they were materialist, and they were mechanistic, and they believed that when you died, you died. That's it. Well, think about that for a moment. Those are pessimistic views of our final state. There's nothing in that that will make you happy. There's nothing in that. There's no way to think about death and feel good about it, because when you die, you're gone, even if whatever it is spiritually that you are continues to exist. It doesn't continue to exist as you. You're gone. Or else there was nothing after death in the case of the Stoics. So they had a fundamentally pessimistic ideology where death was concerned. No one really got out of death alive. And that's unthinkable. That's hard to swallow, that there's nothing bigger than me. That I have nothing to look forward to. Job described it this way, man without hope in God. He said that man that is born of a woman, natural man without a hope in God, man that is born of a woman is of a few days and filled with trouble. That you live your life, it's too short, it's filled with trouble, and that's it. So that's where these Epicureans and Stoics were philosophically, is that they had this negative perspective where afterlife was concerned, and it was unacceptable to them, and so they built an altar to the unknown God. Anything that we're missing, anything that we can't explain, anything that can't give us satisfaction, we can always hope in the unknown God. You know, we really don't need a doctrine of the resurrection of the dead, because once we start specifying those things, we may come up with other problems. So we'll just attribute what we don't know to the unknown God and feel good about our ignorance. So that's what they did. And Paul looked at that, and of course, we're going to find out later on that Paul was very well versed in Epicurean and Stoic philosophy. He was probably as well versed as anybody he was talking to. He grew up in an area where some of the poets that he is quoting came from. And he understands the futility of their religious system, and how that futility is so unacceptable to them that they have this catch-all unknown God to deal with all the questions that they can't answer. And he says, that's the God I'm talking about. He's not a strange God. You're just ignorant of him. There's nothing strange about him. He's been around all along. And you've understood that he's been around all along. You just didn't know why you understood that he's been around all along. And so Paul makes this statement. He says, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him I declare unto you. God has made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and of earth, and dwelleth not in temples made with hands. That's the reason that he's unknown to you, is you believe that God exists in temples that are made with hands, and that he's some kind of a graven image, and he's not, and you realize the truth of that, but you can't put your finger on an explanation for it, so you've erected this altar to an unknown God. Neither is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life, breath, and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed, and the bounds of habitation. Do you notice he said, hath made of one blood all men? There's human equality. There's human equality. If all men are fundamentally the same, then we're fundamentally, so far as our species is concerned, we're equal. We're equal. Several years ago, I was involved with a human genome project when the scientists began to map the human genome. And one of the things that was discovered fairly early on as they began to look at that is that all human beings are 99.997, and you can actually put more nines in that, but we're essentially the same. That the differences in things like the color of your eyes and your hair and the shape of your face, all of that, that falls into not even a 1% difference. Not even a 1% so far as your DNA is concerned. So far as your DNA is concerned. So we really are of one blood. All men. We really are equal. And Paul makes that point, and then he goes on and he says, "That made of one man all nations, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him, and find him, though he be not far from them. For in him, listen to this, in him we live, move, and have our being." You know what Paul is saying? For life, liberty, and well-being originated in man when God created him. That's what Paul is saying here. That's amazing, isn't it? Let's go over to the Genesis account of creation, and we see that that's so in the Genesis account of creation. In the Genesis account, you might recall that the narrative of how God created man. And the first thing that I would submit to you is one of the reasons that it's important that God, one of the reasons that there was a necessity, I'll put it that way, for God to give us human rights is because he created us social beings. And the first evidence that that we're created social beings, and by social beings I mean that we do better with others than we do if we're all by ourselves. And one of the evidences of that is that he said, "Let us make man in our image." Now, God is one God. And he can be one God any way he chooses to be one God. And the way that he chooses to be one God is to be three in one. And the evidence that he is three in one is right there in the statement when he said, "Let us make man in our image." Well, part of being in the image of God is in the same way that God is social, that he gets pleasure from the fact that he is a three-in-one God. We receive pleasure from being social with other men, other human beings. That's one of the things that it means to be created in the image of God. So he made man. Incidentally, the sequence of the description of the making of man is extremely important in the Genesis account. The way that it's presented in the Genesis account is here's how we're going to make man. And so this is how man was made. And then there is account of the making of man. So what he's doing is he's setting forth the principles for the making of man. And then he's saying, and those principles were fulfilled. And then he says, and here are the details of how those principles were fulfilled. You know how he made man? He made man male and female. Before he ever formed Eve, before there was any discussion about making an helpmeet for Adam, it clearly says that he made man in his own image, made he man, male and female. Well, there's a reason for that. And he explains the reason a little bit later on after he's made Eve. He tells Adam and Eve, and this is before original sin, he tells Adam and Eve to go forth and multiply. If man is going to be social, then the socialness of man is going to extend beyond just this one man and this one woman. There's going to be family. You know what comes after family? Society. Society. And of course, you find that in the account, because you find that Adam makes this pronouncement after Eve is made, that she's bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. And he says, for this reason will a man leave his father and mother and take unto him a wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Well, do you know what happens when a young man chooses a wife and leaves home and marries that wife and starts his own household? Now you got mom and dad's household and you got the young man's household. You have community. It's still family, but it's community. It's community. So God makes man. And after he makes man, he creates a place for man. He makes the garden. And he says to man, I've got a place here for you to live. I've made provision for your life. I've given you life, and now I've made provision for your life, and this provision assures you of well-being, and that well-being is sustained as long as you submit to my moral authority. And my moral authority is, you have all these choices that you can make. You can dress the garden. You have dominion over the animals. You can make whatever choices there. This is freedom of will. This is liberty. You have all of these choices that you can make concerning dressing the garden and dominion over the animals and that sort of thing. But I want you to understand that within the framework of your liberty, you are accountable to me. You're accountable to me. And so he gave him a rule, a law. Now understand that God was not being arbitrary when he said, don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You see, here is the lie of Satan. And this is where things like peer pressure come in our lives. And frankly, it's one of the things that has been so disheartening to me, where all of the acrimony is going on in our nation today, is people who call themselves Christians, believe in the Lord, believe that Jesus Christ died for their sins, will engage in the same kind of vitriol that people who don't engage in. Brethren, that ought not to be. We're told to love our neighbors. We're told to love our enemies. We're told to do good to those that despitefully use us. That ought not to be. So the Lord wasn't being arbitrary. He said, goodness is obeying me. If you eat of this tree, you violate goodness, and you will understand by experience what it is to do evil. You know what that does? That makes morality really simple. Obeying God is moral. Disobeying God is immoral. Does it get any simpler than that? You see how simple the Lord has made it for us? And having been born of the Spirit of God and our souls washed in the blood of Christ and sanctified, our born again spirit and the heart of our spirit, which is our soul, has no tolerance for sin. And so David would say, why art thou cast down, my soul? Why art thou disquieted within me? It's not your political opponents that are casting down your soul. It's the response to your political opponents that is doing it. You see, David's issue was his own sin. His issue was his own sin. And the cure for that is not who is President of the United States or Attorney General or on the Supreme Court. The cure for it is, hope thou in God. Hope thou in God. So we see then that in the creation, man being social, God literally gave man life. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. God literally gave him liberty, name the animals, dress the garden. You can do all sorts of things. And he literally gave him an atmosphere in which he could practice well-being. Obey me and things will go good for you. There are your human rights. I'll close with this thought. And we started by asking the question, how do we get into this mess? The reason that we're continuing in this mess is because Christians are not acting like Christians. Okay? We're not hoping in God. We're hoping in other things, and we're engaging in the same kind of tactics that people who are not Christians use to coerce and intimidate. There are two worldviews. One is that man is a created being by an all-powerful, all-knowing, righteous, and holy God. The other is that man is a product of mechanistic process, that we evolved. Now, here's the implication of that. If God made us, then our human rights came from God, and we're under His moral authority to live according to His will. If we're evolved, there's no such thing as human rights. Do you see that? You see, if you didn't begin as a human, and if this is just a mechanistic process that is ongoing, you're not going to end as a human. The human race will not continue as the human race. We'll be something different at some point. We didn't start out as humans. What makes us think we'll continue as humans? How can you have unalterable, inseparable human rights if humanity itself is alterable and if we can be separated by evolution from our humanity? You see the problem? See the problem? That's where the battle is. The answer to the rending of our social fabric today, the answer for Christians is to hope in God. To hope in God. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. When he said, I am the truth, he was saying, I am reality, and all of the experiences that you have in life should be interpreted in the context that I am reality. I am reality. Thank you.